Welcome back. This coming Sunday, The Artist is the odds-on favorite to pick up the Oscar for Best Picture at the 84th Annual Academy Awards. But 10 years from now, will it be the one you remember? Or will you be downloading, or whatever we do, The Descendants, Hugo, or The Tree of Life, some of the other nominees? Over the past 83 years, the Best Picture Oscar winners and the ones raved about years later are not always the same. Take the films of 1941. John Ford's How Green Was My Valley won Best Picture. It tells the story of a poor mining family in Wales. Here's a little of the opening.
I am packing my belongings in the shawl my mother used to wear when she went to the market. And I am going from my valley.
And here's the opening line from another film that was nominated and didn't win. Yes, Orson Welles' Citizen Kane, his story of the fictional newspaper magnate Charles Foster Kane, is considered by many critics to be the greatest film of all time. Let's talk movies that won the Oscar and those that didn't with Boston Globe film critic Wesley Morris. Wesley, good to see you.
Hello, Robin.
You were laughing when you heard the beginning of How Green Is Our Valley compared to Rosebud.
I mean, that dichotomy, I mean, for lack of a better word, it explains the difference between, as you put it, the films you remember and the films that win the Oscar. It isn't so much that How Green Was My Valley is a terrible movie, but it is indicative of yet again the sort of thing the Academy goes for and has always gone for, the thing that best represents their values and speaks to their hearts and honors their sort of ideas of being as good people, a good group of people.
And at the time, I just want to ask, did people say, I am shocked that Citizen Kane didn't win?
No, there were 10 nominees that year. Citizen Kane was but one. I mean, that was a period where, you know, the quality was, I mean, it wasn't so much that it is higher than it is now, but there were fewer movies, and the movies that you wound up seeing, not a lot distinguished them,
right,
in the way that, you know, we now have auteurs to distinguish things. That's what made Citizen Kane such an interesting movie. I mean, you had Hitchcock, who was beginning to become Alfred Hitchcock. And then you have this guy named Orson Welles, who had never made a movie before, but it wasn't like anybody else's movie. It didn't look like anything else. It didn't proceed the way other films proceed. It was formally unlike anything anyone had ever seen before, but it was not, I mean, it was a work of art as opposed to a work of sentiment, as opposed to a moral work.
Let's move on to 52.
Sure.
When The Greatest Show on Earth picked up the Oscar for Best Picture. This was, I mean, it was produced by Cecil B. DeMille.
Which is enough, really.
Right there. Charlton Heston stars as the owner of a circus. Betty Hutton plays one of his stars. Jimmy Stewart plays a clown whose makeup hides the fact that he's a fugitive. In this scene, Betty Hutton and Jimmy Stewart jump on a trampoline and sing.
When things go wrong and life's no song and you're flat on your back, that doesn't mean you have to lie there. Do a jumping jack.
Okay, all right. But it was a fantastic, in the that sense of the word, a big film. The great clown Emmett Kelly appears in it. But what stood out for you that year, 52?
First of all, High Noon, which is the Gary Cooper sort of like Western, and then you had The Quiet Man, which is another John Ford movie, a much more famous one that we still watch today.
It's about a retired boxer.
Yes. Yeah. John Wayne sort of goes to Ireland and, like, you know, falls in love with Maureen O'Hara.
Oh, I could forget.
And, you know, both those movies, High Noon's not a great movie. The Quiet Man has greatness in it. All the shot making is great. It just, I mean, the Greatest Show on Earth is perhaps the most notorious Best Picture winner. It's not so much that High Noon and The Quiet Man are better, although it is. It's just when you look, if you've never seen this movie, have you ever seen it?
I haven't. I suppose I have to, right?
I mean, you should treat yourself, because it's the Ten Commandments of the circus world. Do you know what I mean? Like, it is, I mean, you know, DeMille didn't really know how not to do what he does. So, which, I mean, he could apply that to, like, a garbage strike, and it would get the same result.
Garbage strike.
Right. Yes, Moses basically parts a sea of trash cans or something. I don't know. But 52 stands out more because of the movie that won, more so than the movie that didn't win. Although, you know, in 2012, we're much more likely to have a conversation about High Noon or The Quiet Man than we are to have a conversation about The Greatest Showman. Okay. That's because we basically live that movie now, which is part of the other problem. Like, we've become The Greatest Show on Earth, so there's no real need. It seems somewhat redundant to be like, you know,
to give it an Oscar.
Yeah, just, we've started living it.
Okay, well, there's that. Then 1956, another phantasmagoric film, Around the World in 80 Days, wins Best Picture, based on the Jules Verne novel. David Niven as Phineas Fogg, along with his faithful manservant, they go on a challenge to go around the world in 80 days. In this scene, Charles Boyer plays the French travel agent who has prowess in ballooning. Let's listen.
I have made 63 ascents, gentlemen. To an elevation over 1,000 meters. I've flown through the skies at a speed surpassing that of an eagle.
Are you quite sure, sir, that this is not just a Gallic braggadocio?
Monsieur, you are now addressing the second most celebrated balloonist in Europe.
And who is the first?
He is not available. He was buried last Tuesday.
Charles Boyer, along with Buster Keaton, Noel Coward, Frank Sinatra, Marlena Dietrich. I mean, did they sort of have to give it the Oscar?
Anything that, where you put 10,000 people in a movie and they're all members of the Academy. I mean, they're all, it's in the actors' branch is the largest branch in the Academy. What are you going to do? It's probably going to win. That was the year that you had Giant.
James Dean, a young Elizabeth Taylor.
Yes. You have Angst. You have Oil. You have, you know, just... the story of this family, and you know, you've got great movie making. You've got movie making on a great Hollywood scale. I mean, it looks great, it's in color. The thing about Around the World in 80 Days, aside from it's having all those famous people in it, is that it was a movie that was popular. And you know, I think that at some point the movie sort of really reflected the popular taste, in some ways the Best Picture winners too.
Music from Around the World in 80 Days. Other films that were nominated in 1956 but didn't win the Oscar: Friendly Persuasion, a Civil War film with some star power, Gary Cooper, Dorothy McGuire. The King and I and the Ten Commandments, both Yul Brynner vehicles. He played Ramses in the Ten Commandments, in case you're trying to picture him. By the way, I think I just said Marlena Dietrich. I know it's Dietrich, so don't write about that. But do tell us if you have favorite films that didn't win the Oscar or make the cut. Go to hearnow.org. You can leave a comment there. Or you can head on over to our Facebook page. Go to facebook.com/hearnowradio. Just don't pick a fight about 1979, because Deer Hunter won that year and my brother was in it. So I think it's perhaps the greatest film of all time. We'll have more Oscar history with Wesley of the Boston Globe in 1 minute, here and now. The Los Angeles Times recently took a deep look at the Academy that actually votes for the Oscars and found members to be largely white and male. And our guest today says that has something to do with who wins. Wesley Morris is film critic for the Boston Globe. He's been giving us his thoughts on Oscar winners and losers ahead of Sunday's ceremony. So, Wesley, let's keep going. The Best Picture of 1980 was Robert Redford's Ordinary People, starring Donald Sutherland, Mary Tyler Moore, Timothy Hutton, as a family trying to pull together after the oldest son is killed in a boating accident. In this scene, Donald Sutherland, as the father, tries to take a holiday picture of his wife and surviving son, and you can just hear the tension. Let's listen.
Hold it. Connie, smile.
Calvin!
Just a second. Smile.
Calvin, give me the camera.
No, I didn't get it yet, Beth.
Come on, give me the camera.
Dad, give her the camera.
I want a really good picture of the two of you, okay?
No, but I really want to get a shot of the three of you men. Give me the camera, Calvin.
Not
please.
Until I get a picture of the two of you.
Cal!
Hang on a second.
Give her the damn camera!
Wesley Morris, other films nominated that year: Coal Miner's Daughter, The Elephant Man, mm-hmm. Tess, and Raging Bull.
It's another case. I mean, in this case, it was something new for the Academy, which was this beloved actor directing his first movie.
Robert Redford being the
actor turned director.
Well, also, I'm thinking Mary Tyler Moore played a not entirely sympathetic character. Which
she was, slightly less than sympathetic.
Raging Bull, though, which is Robert De Niro won an Oscar for his portrayal of this real-life boxer, Jake LaMotta, but this was one of Martin Scorsese's many nominations. For a while, he kept getting nominated, not winning.
Right. It's interesting to me that now that's the movie that we... I mean, it seemed to a lot of people like a crime back then. That it didn't win. But it seems even more glaring now, just because Ordinary People went on to sort of inform the culture in one way, and Raging Bull went on to inform the culture in a different way. Ordinary People seems very much now like something you'd find on television. And it's not a slight to the movie itself, but I mean, I think it's just the direction the movies went after that. And Raging Bull is just, it still feels like
art.
It just happened. You know,
but doesn't it also feel more like art?
It's a work of art.
Well, I'm wondering, too, if in 1980, Ordinary People also was, you had to be in that time to understand. I mean, this was sort of the launching, this was before Oprah. So this.
Oh, sure. The therapy.
Talking about family issues and talking about things like suicide and a mother who was cold. And this was sort of launching that, too.
Yes. And but that's what I'm saying. I mean, but that sort of wound up going in this other direction. And it didn't really inform the movies. The part of the reason we don't talk about it in the way that we do Raging Bull is because the thematic innovations of that movie, the things that we didn't often see in movies before, wound up sort of more being played out very well on television.
Everywhere.
Right, everywhere. Right. But, I mean, if we're looking at a medium, you know, books and TV, not movies.
Right.
And so the things that we remember about the movies that we can't believe didn't win the Oscar are movies that we still regard for, in many ways, their moviness.
Right, as opposed to their social messages.
Right, there's no moviness necessarily about Ordinary People.
Well, the very next year, 81, the film that won Best Picture, let's give it a musical introduction. Of course, Chariots of Fire. Other films nominated that year, Raiders of the Lost Ark, On Golden Pond, Atlantic City, Warren Beatty's Reds, which you think also could have won. So comment on this year.
The Chariots of Fire victory is significant because it began what the 80s became known as. What happened in the 80s was these prestige movies sort of took over. So you had all these films that, it wasn't even so much that they had a social message. They just had costumes. They had, you know, this spirit. And Reds had costumes. But I also think that you couldn't give two best director, best picture situations in a row to an actor directing.
Right.
So this little British movie about the runners.
Oh, come on. They were runners and they were surviving all sorts of things.
Yeah, no. But I mean, I think that I think war is hugely appealing to the Academy because it brings in the sound people, it brings in the costumers, it brings in the writing, the directing, it brings in the music, Vangelis, how can you not, you know, who can forget? It brings in on the same page these disparate elements of the Academy and it allows, once again, for these movies to sweep the awards. Yeah. I mean, Chariots of Fire wasn't a sweep situation, but if you just fast forward to 1987... Last Emperor beats out Fatal Attraction and Moonstruck and Broadcast News. Hope and Glory, ironically, was the movie that might have won the John Borman movie about the Blitz, basically. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a funny thing, the Oscars, what you remember talking about or what you wind up talking about 25 years or, you know, 30 years after the fact.
Right. Well, I hear Broadcast News mentioned far more than The Last Emperor, but
yeah, I mean, it just doesn't. Right. There's no, but it allows these people as a group who we now also know who they are thanks to the Los Angeles Times, 5,700 or so white guys who are about 62 years old, who really love these sorts of movies. They speak to craftsmanship on several different levels. That report really opens up a whole universe of understanding, both about how the awards get won and the movies get made.
Yeah, I mean, you're pointing out that the Academy Award voters, predominantly white, male, and have never won an Oscar.
Yeah, there's that, too. I mean, but what we're talking about really is the Academy does one thing, but what we wind up remembering is a different thing. And it doesn't sort of make the Oscars irrelevant, but it does sort of change what we are meant to glean from what their social value is. Do they have any social value? It's an interesting question to have to ask year after year and to sort of roll your eyes as you sit there and watch this show year after year, knowing, especially, you know, suspecting always that the Academy basically was made up of people who didn't look like America necessarily. They looked like towns in America, but not, you know, the entire country.
They look like towns in America in 1950. Well, Wesley Morris, let's give you your opportunity. What do you think is going to win Sunday night? What do you think should win?
I don't think there's any way The Artist is going to lose. I don't think that enough people feel as magically transported by Hugo, which happens to be made by Martin Scorsese. And I also think that the thing about The Artist that people like is just how surprised they were by how charming it is.
Yeah. But what do you think should win? And by the way, is there one that you think should have been nominated and wasn't?
This is not a thrilling bunch of movies for me. I think The Tree of Life is the one that really, I don't know. I mean, I feel like that's a movie that we might wind up talking about or fighting over in the years to come.
Wow. And, not that many people saw it because this is, again,
more people saw it than I thought were going to, honestly. But I think for Academy voters, it's just too much. I mean, it's just too divisive, I think, to actually be on enough ballots to win. So I think The Artist is... And the movie that I most wanted to see there's a couple. I mean, they're popular movies like Bridesmaids, which was never going to be a nominee, as we discussed before, and something like Raja the Planet of the Apes. So, I mean, yeah, it's a shame that they're not there. I wish that at least one of them had made the cut. It would give me something to, not so much that I'd want to vote for it or I want people to vote for it, but it would tell a better picture of... It would provide a better snapshot of what 2011 was like for movies.
Right, who we were in 2011.
Than these movies do.
Wesley Morris of the Boston Globe, thanks so much. And we'll have a list of the winners and the runners-up. Thanks so much.
Thank you.